last couple of weeks, I've really been on a roll here. So as we start our 15th class in the study of Leviticus, I once again have to admit, to making a mistake. When I realized this one, I just had to laugh. Brethren, Leviticus actually has 27 chapters. And so I have put up this outline before you. I think I counted 8 times in the last 15 weeks I'm teaching this class. And so the first 7 chapters have these 5 primary sacrifices, and 8 through 10 is indeed about initiating the priesthood, and 11 through 15 distinguishes clean and unclean, 16 is about the Day of Atonement. But I've been putting this line 17 through 26 in front of you week after week after week. And it should be 17 through 27. And so we are in the midst of that discussion now, and going to be taking on chapter 21 in a minute. But I thought you might appreciate just knowing. First, I'm really impressed with this class. I realize Leviticus is, really a tough book from the standpoint that, it's very devoted to these priests that we haven't had any need for in 2,000 years. Their function as mediators or intermediaries between God and man for just the Jews and the little while of Moses' law in that one country, is long gone. And so as we read about all these very esoteric and intricate kinds of things, it can be, kind of tough. But we have already covered chapter 24 in an earlier lesson when we were dealing with the festivals. And so there are now 215 verses, if you count tonight's verses, that are left. Total of 6 chapters then, since we've already covered 24. And sat down and did some calculating and looking at these chapters, and decided that what we're going to do is to have tonight's class and 3 more for a total of 4 more classes. Ultimately, on the book of Leviticus, then we'll finish out with a total of 18 lessons on these 27 chapters. And so I'm very happy with that. I know it can be hard on you, but I hope you are too. It's not even, one chapter per night, so we're really going fairly fast for the nature of the material in particular. Bill, yeah. I just missed the last part. You kind of trailed off there.
Exodus 20 through 23.
Yes.
I believe that's the first recounting of any of the laws, or the first giving of any of the laws.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm not sure if you were here last week or not. Lee had pointed out that on that chart I did on Old Testament sexual prohibitions, I needed to add 2 lines from Exodus 20. And so, that chart is a little bit different. I amended it, to reflect that. But yeah, absolutely. The law first came in Sinai, Exodus chapter 20. We have been looking at Leviticus, though, of course. And so I've been designing charts that have drawn from other books, but primarily been limited to this. But we did get a couple of those slides on there from last week. So, what we're going to do this evening is, this will be the only chart that I'm going to show, and all it's going to do is just simply list, as we go through each of the segments now of chapters 21 and 22, you'll have a title if you'd like to use some sort of parenthetical mark, and group the verses. That's really the only function for this chart tonight. The material is fairly straightforward. There's a couple of places, though, that are going to give us some very interesting insights into those issues regarding marriage and divorce and what's classically styled as remarriage, that is kind of springboarding off a few verses that we study in the Sermon on the Mount, material that we've been studying at some length in chapters 5 and 6 in 1 Corinthians on Sunday mornings, and going to be looking at in very great detail in the upcoming weeks, probably spend a couple of months, in fact, revolving around marriage, divorce, and remarriage, starting on Sunday morning, actually, with 1 Corinthians chapter 7. But there's some related material that we'll be looking at here tonight. So I think you'll find this helpful if you just want to make notes, you know, write something in your margin about the nature of the material. Here, as you can see, as I've entitled it, this great lesson regarding defilement. In the first six verses of chapter 21, it says this: "The Lord said to Moses, speak to the priests." Now remember, in a moment we're going to find out about the high priest. So the high priest is a priest, but this is for all the priests. "The Lord said to Moses, speak to the priests, the sons of Aaron, and say to them, no one shall defile himself for a person among his people, except for his relatives who are nearest to him, his mother and his father, and his son and his daughter, and his brother, also for his virgin sister who is near to him, because she's had no husband. For her, he may defile himself." Here's a permission to defile yourself in verse 3. And now verse 4, "He shall not defile himself as a relative by marriage among his people and so profane himself. They shall not make any baldness on their heads, nor shave off the edges of their beards." There's a famous law that you know, some of the skeptics just love. "Nor make any cuts in their flesh. They shall be holy to their God and not profane the name of their God, for they present the offerings by fire to the Lord, the bread of their God, so they shall be holy." The opposite of being defiled is being holy. Now, can anybody figure out, because, you know, it's there, but it's not really, in these first few verses where he talks about defiling yourself for a person, except for relatives that are nearest, not for relatives, you know, that are in-laws that you've married into, what is this defilement? Do you know what it is he's talking about? Pardon me? For the dead. You may not touch, as a priest, any dead body unless it is a near relative and they're named your mother, your father, your son, your daughter, your brother, your virgin sister. You may defile yourself for them. So we note, obviously, this is not a permission to sin as we would classically define it. So it's a defilement, but it's not a moral failing. It's not, you know, a sin where God said, don't do this, and now you went and did it anyway, so you have transgressed the law. They're not transgressing a law here at all, are they? They're being given permission as to who they may weep and lament over, who it is that they may prepare for burial, and who they may not. So you learn something, that's why I said great lesson, regarding defilements. And we need to be very careful about it. Quite often, these things get confused. We have a statement about a defilement, and then we kind of assume that this person then has broken a law. That is not necessarily the case. Though often it is the case, if you break a law, do you defile yourself? Sure you do. But in this case, the nature of the things that we're talking about, are they inherently sinful? Has God decreed somewhere when a dead body is found or somebody has a heart attack in your house, you just have to let it rot because you can't touch it? And so if you do, then you've sinned. No, it's not like that at all. Go ahead, Harry. It's just like the diet restrictions, precisely. And there's quite a large number of things, as a matter of fact, that you'll find in the law. Now, some of these will apply to all the people. Some of these will apply to the priests. And we're about to find out, though I'm going to rearrange the chapter a little bit, some will apply only to high priests as opposed to the general body of the priests. So you have to be, I'm just saying, be very careful in any context. A defilement may be something in which you are completely innocent and often enough was entirely unavoidable. You had no control over it. There wasn't any choice made at all. In this case, there are choices being made, But not all defilements are the same defilements. Not all defilements are a violation of the law. But when you're defiled, it simply means you have been set apart in much the same way that if you're holy, you've been set apart. And I think it might be helpful if we'd always think about it that way. Whether you're being set apart as holy or set apart as defiled, in both cases, what is uniform is you've been set apart. You may have been set apart for some particular thing that one might think of as an honor, as a blessing, as a responsibility that God wants done. Or you may be set apart because now you're not qualified for a period of time and until you go through a cleansing to go back to this other service. So, but in either case, you've been set apart to do a thing or not to do a thing until the defilement can be removed. But sin, as we think about it, a conscious choice to not do or to do what God has forbidden or expected, it's not necessarily involved at all. And I thought I saw another hand up somewhere back there. Okay. All right, so there's just a lot to learn right there about the nature of defilements in general in these six verses. But, obviously, if a close relative dies, it'd be next to impossible to not, come in contact to properly weep and grieve over this individual. That's natural, that's normal, that's human, and God's not going to deny that of these people under these certain circumstances. But are they not still God's priests? They still are. So they are still held to a higher standard. There are fewer people that they would be able to come into contact with. And so God sets up a system that's designed, though, to say to everybody in the Jewish politic, what about these priests? They have a special relationship to God that not everybody has. And in order to fulfill that relationship, they have to be separate to a degree and an amount that is greater than the rest of the general population. So, any comment or question about the first six verses? All right. Now, I said I would take it out of order because I'd like for you to see now verses 10 through 12. It's going to do the same thing about defilements, but this now separates the high priest himself. We'll come back to the intervening verses here in just a minute, but I thought I'd put these two together. So look now at verses 10 through 12. The priest who is the highest among his brothers, on whose head the anointing oil has been poured, who has been consecrated to wear the garments, shall not uncover his head, nor tear his clothes, nor shall he approach any dead person, nor defile himself for his father or his mother, nor shall he go out of the sanctuary, nor profane the sanctuary of his God. For the consecrations of the anointing oil of his God is on him. I am Yahweh. Personal name of God. I am Yahweh. I'm not Molech, I'm not Astarte, I'm not any of these others. I am Yahweh, and if I designate you as my high priest, you are so utterly and totally devoted to me because you are allowed to be closer to me and to perform functions for me as your God that no one else can do. Then, even if your mother or your father or the continuing list we got out of the first six verses of your near relatives and certainly nobody else may you defile yourself for, you can't even go to the funeral. You stay there in the sanctuary performing your duties. Now, it's kind of reminiscent to that first high priest. Who's the first high priest? Okay, and what happened to two of his boys? What were their names? Nadab and Abihu. What chapter was that? Leviticus chapter 10. Tremendously important chapter. You always want to remember that. You go there and show this example. God's serious about things being done his way. No matter what we think about it, he says the things to be done this way. That's the only way that it can be done. So, when Nadab and Abihu were struck down because they simply presumed to offer a fire that God had never forbidden, but more importantly, had never authorized, he'd never permitted, he'd never said they could use, They went ahead and used something else. As soon as they did, they're struck dead. And immediately God says to Aaron, what? You may not shed a tear. Yeah, you can't display any of the societal customs of your Jewish people when a terrible loss like this has taken place. You're the high priest. Now that must have been some kind of day. As I've suggested, it looks very likely that it was the very first day that the priesthood was being set up. On that very first day, we got two rebellious sons. On that very first day, this high priest, the very first one, finds out that he is not even allowed to grieve for his two sons in this event. Imagine how hard that had to be. The degree of self-control that would have to be mustered. I think everybody in this room knew Jerry Bassett, knew him well, knew him a long time. I used to marvel when Jerry would perform a funeral. Some of you probably all talked to him about it. I asked him about it one time. Jerry, how in the world do you do that? I usually get broken up. I will often cry. You know, my voice breaks. I just get caught up in it emotionally, you know. And Jerry's response was just so stoic and so military and so disciplined, you know, and so very impressive to me. You know, he just said, I believe I have a duty before God and man to control myself in those circumstances. And I didn't say this to him, but I was thinking, well, I'm glad I don't feel that way, because I go ahead and I just break down and I don't even apologize for it. just the difference between the two of us. But the fact that Jerry had that discipline, he did not love these people that we've lost in these last 7 years now. Of course, he's been gone nearly two. But it's, you know, these were people that were dear and precious to him. And so, you know, he was as caught up as all the rest of us were in that emotion. But because he had set himself apart, he would not permit it. And it was awesome to behold, wasn't it? Hey, I think he was every bit as emotional a man as any of us. Loved everybody that we've lost, and it's quite a few in these last few years, you know, as much as anybody ever did. But he decided he was going to be like that high priest. He was going to make, you know, the world know that he was in charge. He was in control of his emotions. Well, every high priest is being called to that in these verses. Okay, now to go back to the intervening verses, 7 through 9. Now we're going to talk, as I mentioned, about material that has at least an oblique relationship to the great studies on marriage and divorce and remarriage, which have plagued God's people throughout all the history of the Jews, throughout all the history of Christianity. Has always been a terrible, a divisive, controversial kind of a subject here. But look at chapter 21 now, verses 7 through 9. They, now in the first six verses, who were we addressing? Priests in general. The high priest got separated later, but here's the priest in general still. Verse 7, they shall not take a woman who is profaned by harlotry. If she's been caught in sexual sin of any kind, then he may not take her. Well, that means marry her. A priest may not marry a woman who's been profaned by harlotry. Now, I took you through the whole list, you know, of all these sexual sins, gave everybody charts and all of that, quite a few of these. In fact, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 specifically carry the death penalty. But what did we point out at that time? Can you read about anybody who is put to death because of a sexual sin in the Old Testament? Well, no. And why not? Why is that? No witnesses. You have to have the witnesses. So here in this case, she still lives. She's been caught enough that she has a reputation for this, but you can't find the witnesses. Yet still, there's that cloud that's hanging over her. Can a priest marry that woman? No. But by implication here, could she marry anybody else? Well, sure she could. And anybody else could marry her. You'd think twice about it, I hope, if you had any kind of smarts at all. You know, clearly this is a woman that's got a bad reputation and for a reason, and therefore probably has weaknesses. It ought to cause some pause here. But she is not put to death, nor is she condemned to celibacy. That just doesn't happen in the Old Testament. Then we have the rest of the verse, nor shall they take a woman divorced from her husband. Well, what does that tell you about women who have been divorced from their husbands? Could they marry into the general population? Sure they could. Of course they could. Deuteronomy 24 specifically says so. Tells you about certificate of divorce. So that she could marry another man. But could she marry a priest? No. She's permitted to marry. She's not condemned to celibacy. We're not going to practice the doctrine of demons on her. But she could marry other people, but not a priest. They're held to a higher standard. That is given at the end of verse 7. He's holy to his God. You shall consecrate him, therefore, for he offers the bread of your God. He shall be holy to you, for I, Yahweh, who sanctifies you, am holy. Also, the daughter of any priest, if she profanes herself by harlotry. People get caught all the time by one person, but you need two or three for this death penalty. Some of these didn't carry death penalties anyway. But she gets caught, you know, well, she profanes her what in verse 9? She profanes her father. She shall be what? Burned with fire. Are they all burned with fire? I gave you the list. The penalties are listed. What's the one that gets burnt with fire? The priest's daughter. Now, other women might do this, and they're not either condemned to celibacy or put to death. But the priest's daughter, she has to be held to a higher standard. The family is held to a higher standard. When we come to the New Testament, we're talking about qualifications for an elder. Is his family held to a higher standard than others? It is. He's not qualified and may not serve unless certain qualifications are met, which involve his family and demonstrate his leadership. I've been communicating with a man in another state who has, over the last couple of years, a guy moved in from another state to become their preacher. Didn't let on at the beginning, but then before too long started teaching the congregation, but freely admitted once he got rolling that the congregation that he had left did not believe, and apparently part of the reason why he left, what he was about to teach this other congregation. But he taught them that no elder has to have believing children at all. Believing children should be redefined as meaning they were not rebellious, they were obedient to their daddy while they were at home. But they may have been out of the house for 20 years and need not ever have come to Christ. And if you like the guy, you can make him an elder anyway. So, wait a minute. You know, how then is this standard any higher for those elders? Everybody ought to have children, you know, that are under submission while they're at home. But these qualifications are about at the moment that you're going to decide whether or not this man is qualified. At that moment, not 20 years ago, at that moment, does he meet some or all of those qualifications? All of those qualifications. So it's very similar with elders who have a heightened degree of responsibility, and we are told to give double honor if they are also preachers who are already worthy of extra honor. You know, they have to meet a higher standard, and it involves their family. That's exactly what's going on in the old law. God has always expected something more out of his leaders if they're going to be influential in serving God in some special capacity and in leading the people in that capacity. So it's just, it's interesting material here, verses 7 through 9. They shall not take a woman who's profaned by harlotry. They shall not take a woman divorced from her husband. And the daughter of a priest, if she gets caught in harlotry, shall be put to death. But she's not stoned. She's burned with fire. That's something else. And then, now, to see, you know, how I lead into the two defilements and now information on what I'm calling legal or illegal marriages. Let's skip down now to verses 13 through 15, where again, now he singles out the high priest with regard to these marriage relationships again. So in 13, he, now we're talking about the high priest, he shall take a wife in her virginity. A widow or a divorced woman or one who is profaned by harlotry, these he may not take. But rather, he is to marry a virgin of his own people, that he may not profane his offspring among his people. For I am the Lord who sanctifies him. Is his family being held to a higher standard? Yes, it is. Is he being held to a higher standard? Yes, he is. Could any man marry a virgin? Sure, any man could marry a virgin. Could any man marry a widow? Except the high priest. Any other man could. Can any man marry a divorced woman? Well, sure. Except the high priest. If nobody could marry a divorced woman, you don't have to tell the high priest you can't marry a divorced woman. He's being separated from those who can. And then it says, or one who's profaned by harlotry, which we saw was the responsibility of all the priests as well. Rather, he is to marry a virgin of his own people. These others may be permissible for everybody else, but they're not permissible for you. So we'll be getting into the details for probably 8 weeks, I'm guessing, on this whole marriage, divorce, and remarriage thing. Here's some, at least, observations about the nature of the law back in the old times for the Jews. Now, verses 16 through 24, so now we'll be able to just complete the 21st chapter. Verses 16 through 24, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying. Now, what you'll notice with these first four, you know, the only designation is priest or high priest, priest or high priest. But from now on, each of these groups is going to be singled out like that verse 16. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying. So clearly, it's at a different time or it's on a different subject. It'll be on a different subject. But when they're designated like that, until you get to the next one, is how I block these out. So 16 through 24 is on this one occasion, I guess, at least, in chapter 21, verses 16 through 24. Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron. Aaron is the what? He's the high priest. But you tell Aaron this, no man of your offspring throughout their generations who has a defect shall approach to offer the bread of his God. For no one who has a defect shall approach. A blind man, is it his fault that he's blind? Does it say somewhere he gouged out his own eyes? No. A lame man, is it his fault that he's a lame man? Suppose it might be. My youngest son, 37 years old, kind of an avid rock climber type, jumped down off a wall. He figured it was about 15 feet and rolled his ankle, and so he's going to be laid up. You know, he's on crutches too. So yeah, you know, you can twist an ankle, you can break a leg, and all that. And maybe you did something really stupid that made it happen. One of my dad's favorite stories. Pretty tough character, my dad, and working with horses, you know, most of his life. And so he always on a ranch and had these big dumpsters, you know, and they were filling every week. And so the guy that comes to load the dumpsters had banged up one of his dumpsters. So my dad got up there and he's teetering on the corner, you know, one of these dumpsters come from on either side. And he's wielding one of these log splitters, you know, that's got the mallet on the end. So he's got this giant sledgehammer. Bam! He's hitting that metal right beneath his foot. Bam! He's hitting that metal. He goes straightening it out. Then what happened? Bam! He broke his ankle. Fell off in the dirt. You know, wow! So, okay. You know, what do we call that? Call it stupid. Go ahead, I did. Yeah, but it's also an accident, isn't it? It's an accident. But once that's happened, then what? He got you a defect. Okay? Now, we're not going to say it's a sin. You didn't break a law. You didn't make some moral decision. But still, you got a defect. You got a problem. So the next one is, in verse 18, has a disfigured, they've added the word face, or any deformed, and they added the word limb, But when it comes to if he's disfigured in any way, if he's deformed in any way, well, brethren, these are usually, you know, by birth. Though some problems, you know, can develop from accidents and disease. Or 19, a man who has a broken foot, a broken hand, a hunchback, a dwarf, or defect in his eye, eczema, scabs, or crushed testicles. You're not qualified. Can't do it. Now, where's the sin? There's no sin, but it's a defect. So in the physical sense, as well as in the moral sense, if you're going to be a priest or a high priest, then what? You're not just born into it. You still have to meet some really high standards, separate yourself from normal life to an amazing degree, and for a high priest up to and including disciplining yourself so you don't even grieve for those you love. Harry again.
I think that's a tough job, being a high priest.
I'm telling you, it's a tough job. It's a tough job to be a regular priest. And when we were studying about these sacrifices and all that too, extremely athletic. These were tough dudes. They handled a lot of weight all day long. They were lifting. They were wrestling with animals to slaughter them, you know. And so these were serious guys. Okay, Carol?
Well, Christ had to hold himself to a high standard to be able to be our high priest on this earth. So.
See, exactly. And so you see parallels, types, shadows, as we come into the New Testament as well. Bill?
All of these things that were listed are the same things that are required for sacrificial animals. They had to be perfect.
Yeah, we'll get to that in time too.
These priests, they were perpetual offerings before God.
Yeah, that'll be coming up. And so that's it. God's making a point. He's making it pretty strongly. But there's no sin involved. The man's not being charged with a crime. He's suffering a problem that's wholly beyond his control, but you're still set apart. You're defiled. You have a defect. You can't serve. 21. No man among the descendants of Aaron the priest who has a defect is to come near to offer the Lord's offerings by fire. Since he has a defect, he shall not come near to offer the bread of his God. So he may be a Levite. He may be in the right tribe, but he is not going to serve. He may eat the bread of his God in verse 22. Both of the most holy and of the holy. Only he shall not go in to the veil or come near the altar because he has a defect, that he may not profane my sanctuaries. Now that's not, you know, because he's a sinner. And again, let's think about this word now, profane. What does profane mean? Common is what it means. We usually think dirty somehow, but it doesn't. It just means common, ordinary. If you use something in a profane way in our culture, we think obscene. It's really not the way that word would have been understood. It just means it's for the common things that everybody does, not for priests. They're not common. So he may not profane my sanctuaries. I am the Lord who sanctifies them. So Moses spoke to Aaron and to his sons and to all the sons of Israel. So they not only on that first day had gone through all the ceremonial cleansing and the sprinklings of blood, you know, and a very elaborate ceremony, you know, that took place back in chapters 8 through 10. But they were being constantly reminded and they were being asked to be ever mindful of their separation from the normal things of this earth. Would Paul tell Timothy something similar and use a military example? Sure. No man in the military, you know, is going to be entangled in the affairs of this world. And that's right. You've been set apart now for a different purpose. So these settings of parts don't necessarily involve sin at all. Though if you sinned, that might also result that you'd be set apart. Okay, now we're going to roll on into chapter 22 and take the first 16 verses. It's a big block. But this is all about who may and who may not eat from what are called holy gifts. What are the holy gifts? The sacrifices. All over Israel, people have to come to the altar and at the tabernacle's location, and then finally in the temple's location, once Solomon builds it. But when these offerings are brought and the animal is slaughtered, in most cases, the meat then becomes food for the families of the priests. We've already talked about that a moment ago, with these defects. And now we're going to get into that even more deeply here as we start off chapter 22. So it reads like this. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, tell Aaron and his sons, tell the high priest and those in his family below, be careful with the holy gifts of the sons of Israel, which they dedicate to me, so as not to profane my holy name. I am Yahweh. God's name was intended, because of the nature of what that name represents, to be revered, to be respected and honored and elevated to an immense degree. It is not to be used as a common word. If ever there was a sin that is both ubiquitous and particularly vile due to its blasphemous nature, it is the way our culture and the rest of the world uses the name of God. Now, we spend a lot of time together. We sing our hymns. We use the word hallelujah. Hail Jehovah. Hail Yahweh. Every time we use it, do we mean it with respect? Do we mean it with honor? Do we mean it with joy? Do we mean it in a manner that is intended to give God his due as far superior to us? Absolutely. But most of the time, in our culture, at work, at play, at television, radio, and everywhere, somebody shouts hallelujah, and what do they mean? They caught the dog that ran away. And they are profaning the name of God. This is a high crime. A high crime. And it is perhaps the most common in our culture. And of course, just using the word God, using the word Jesus, using the word Christ, the way that people do, as just common expressions. And expressions, that often involve invoking the name of God to do something. I've had a couple of friends, as a matter of fact, through the years, I've known personally. And they would hear somebody say, God damn it, or God damn you. And they actually would have the backbone to stop the individual who's just using it in complete vacuous emptiness because they hit their thumb with a hammer. And he would say, do you really expect God to condemn what? Your thumb? Your hammer? You? What are you asking God to do? I was real proud of that guy. That took a lot of courage. And as I said, it was more than one that I've known of that would do this. Good for them. This is not a thing to be tolerated. This is not a thing to be overlooked. This is not a thing that's just meaningless. I've told you before, I think in terms of having three fathers. My biological father, my physical father, taught me a lot of about the world but never came to Christ. And then I have a sort of a spiritual father in Lowell Williams. I was tremendously close to him, spent a lot of years with him. He taught me, so much about Scripture. And then there was Wendell Smith, still is Wendell Smith, only one still surviving among the three. Wendell Smith taught me how to be a Christian on the job. We were doing a big-time job one time. I'm talking about a really expensive house. We were building this custom home, and the mason came out, built this chimney, and he was just carrying on, swearing like crazy. And so Wendell walked over. Wendell had done things like this, but now that I think about it, it was the owner of the house, as a matter of fact. He walked up to the guy, and he said, didn't your mother ever wash your mouth out with soap? Now, how many of you guys know what masons look like? Gorillas. Right? And for him to walk up like that is quite a display of conviction, of courage, insisting the name of his God be respected. Not going to just accept this. Once again, brother, one of the things I just drives me crazy is when somebody says, pardon my French. Now, I've told you before, we've talked about this. What is really the only appropriate response to that? I've heard a little French, and that's not it. what you're doing shouldn't be pardoned, shouldn't be forgiven. It should be stopped. When are we going to rise up? Show the world we believe in a God who will judge us, whose name is above all others. He is the great I Am. That means something to God. So he says, not going to do these things. In verse, where did I go? Three. Say to him, any man among all your descendants throughout your generations approaches the holy gifts which the sons of Israel dedicate to the Lord while he has an uncleanness, that person shall be cut off from me. I am the Lord. So we've been talking about profanity. You know what's profane? You don't use the name. You don't use any of these things in a common manner. And if this guy approaches the gifts while he has an uncleanness, at the end of verse 3, he'll be cut off from before me. And we talked about that. I admit it. I'm not sure what that means. In some cases, it carries the death penalty. In other cases, it seems only to be exiled. But in either way, you're being eliminated from, again, the Jewish body. You are expunged. You are kicked out like the guy in 1 Corinthians 5. Verse 4, at least, or else also put to death. Verse 4, no man of the descendants of Aaron who is a leper, is that your fault? Or he has a discharge, is that your fault? May eat of the holy gifts until he's clean. If one touches anything made unclean by a corpse, or if a man has a seminal emission, or if a man touches any teeming things by which he's made unclean, or any man by whom he is made unclean, whatever is uncleanness, a person who touches any such shall be unclean until evening. Shall not eat of the holy gifts, lest he's bathed his body in water, but when the sun sets, he shall be clean. Afterward, he shall eat of the holy gifts, for it is his food. So he's a part of the family. Ordinarily he can eat, but only if he's clean. 8. He shall not eat that which dies or is torn, becoming unclean by it. I am the Lord. Every animal that the Jews ate had to be what first? Slaughtered. You had to take a living animal, put it to death, then you can eat it. If you find an animal has died. Now, brethren, you might be tending a large flock of cattle. You know, cow's there. You go in for lunch. You come back, cow's dead. Can you eat it? No, and it's a big loss. But you did not slaughter the animal. It died of natural causes. You're not going to know what those causes are, but it's defiled. You can't eat it. Harry?
Wouldn't you say that it would be sanctified?
Yes. Exactly, and thank you for that. It's sanctified, both the people and these offerings. And once they've been sanctified, set apart, certain requirements are going to follow. And same thing, you find one's been torn by beasts. So out in the field, gets attacked, a lion, a bear, they get quite a number of animals it could attack. You know, and now it comes limping back into the camp. You know, it's torn to pieces and bleeds out and dies right there in front of you. What then? Can't eat it. It's a big loss financially. You know, it's a big deal. I'm sorry, you can't do it. Do you know if the animal is rabid? Do you know? You know, circumcised? No. You know, so we can wonder about why God would do these things, but all they needed to know was you couldn't. Verse 9. They shall therefore keep and remember now. What's the last four words in verse 8? I am Yahweh. You don't profane my name or anything about me. 9. They shall therefore keep my charge so that they may not bear sin because of it and die thereby because they profane it. I am the Lord who sanctifies them. Now, if God has given these prohibitions, you can't eat an animal you come upon that's dead, you can't eat an animal that's been torn by beast, and whether you find it or it comes home, you know, and then dies. If you then choose to do that, have you now in that classic sense, in that moral sense, have you now sinned in that manner? Well, sure you have. You looked right at that commandment and you decided you weren't going to do it. No, I won't. Well, now that's a whole order of magnitude different, isn't it? This is a choice you've made to ignore, fly in the face, disobey, and rebel against a specific command that God has given. That's a moral failing. That's a choice that you made, as opposed to most everything else we've talked about here this evening. But, nine, let's read it all. They shall therefore keep my charge, so that they may not bear sin because of it, and die thereby because they profane it. I am the Lord who sanctifies them. Now, whether this death would be that it carries a death penalty, we've seen the witnesses now, you know, and they would be put to death, or if it means that God would take that matter into his own hands, we don't know. I don't know. Has God not struck some people dead himself personally in both the Old and New Testaments? Sure he has. Quite a few occasions, as a matter of fact. So, now I'm not sure which it would be here, whether, you know, there's been a judicial proceeding and then he's put to death, but there's the case. Okay, so, 10. No layman, however, is to eat the holy gift. Sojourner with the priest or a hired hand shall not eat of the holy gifts. But if a priest buys a slave as his property with his money, that one may eat of it. And those who are born in his house may eat of his food. Now, let's just stop there for just a second. And believe me, I don't want to get into this one. So y'all hold your comments, questions, and all the rest of that. But brethren, here we have a statement about, verse 11, a priest buying what? A slave. If the priest buys a slave, has he committed a sin?
No.
He's not committed a sin. Is it a sin for slavery to exist and for slaves to exist and for masters to exist? It's not. Now, I know in our culture and time, we're being taught that it is. That is an indictment against God. Let's be real careful about this. Slavery was perfectly legal in God's mind. He gave the laws that managed slavery. Now then, this thing then cannot be inherently and morally evil, as our culture currently teaches. As if they knew anything about what's morally evil. You know, most of them have abandoned the Bible altogether. But nonetheless, God, how much darkness is there in him? So how much sin, moral sin, inherent evil, will God permit ever? None. He doesn't do that.
Wouldn't you consider that Jacob was a slave to Laban? In order to obtain his wife from Laban. So he worked 7 years for that.
7 years and got cheated, and then what?
Had to
do seven more. Even when he's being cheated. Now, does that mean that I'm endorsing slavery or trying to bring it back? Well, of course not. And I'm glad it's gone. All I'm trying to do is to be a very careful Bible student and make sure that we just don't go jumping to conclusions like is most often the case. When we start talking today about slavery being an inherent moral evil, you are passing a judgment on God who does not think so. As a matter of fact, when you're baptized into Christ, what exactly do you become? A slave. And what is he? The Lord. How much inherent evil is there in this relationship? Absolutely none. So, like some of the topics we've been studying in recent weeks, here's another one for you. I grant, you got to be awful careful in our culture today. These people haven't got a clue what the Bible teaches, but they pass a lot of laws that could cause you an enormous amounts of grief based on their ignorance, where they've decided that God was wrong and that slavery in and of itself is an inherent moral crime. It isn't now, it wasn't then, and it never has been by God's definition. But you have to know your Bible. You have to be awful careful when you're talking to people about this, because believe you me, they'll freak out. So be careful. But know this, at least among ourselves, not inherently evil. Can't be immoral. It can't be. or God would not permit it, ever. Old Testament, New Testament, any time. That's a very important principle. God doesn't yield to sin. So we better stop defining it differently than he does. So then, in verse 11, if a priest buys a slave, which is perfectly fine, as property with his money, that one may eat of it, and those who are born in his house may eat of his food. He does have to take care of them. You do have to treat them right, or the master's in trouble. And if a priest's daughter is married to a layman, she shall not eat of the offering of the fruit. So if she marries outside that family, she's cut off from that source of food. It's holy food. She's gone, left the family. 13, but if a priest's daughter becomes a widow or divorced, has no child and returns to her father's house as in her youth, she shall eat of her father's food, but no layman shall eat it. So you could come out from underneath the father's umbrella. You had been eating of the food because you were his daughter. You married somebody outside, you know, a layman. So now you can't eat of that priestly food. But if your mate dies, you come back childless, so the child would take care of her otherwise. She's got nobody. She comes back to the father. She can eat the food again. 14. But if a man eats a holy gift unintentionally, then he shall add to it a fifth of it and shall give the holy gift to the priest. They shall not profane the holy gifts of the sons of Israel, which they offer to Yahweh, and so cause them to bear punishment for guilt by eating their holy gifts, for I am the Lord who sanctifies them. Now, obviously, I'm running out of time, but see, look at it. I forgot. I wanted to mention in verse 9, they shall therefore keep my charge so that they may not bear what? May not bear sin. Remember, there was a moral choice. But sin in and of itself just means to miss the mark. You haven't done what was right. Sometimes you can find yourself committing a sin that isn't a choice. It's not a moral crime, but it's still viewed as missing the mark, stepping on a grave, these kinds of things. So, you know, you have to spend some time thinking about these terms to get a clearer picture of how they actually work and relate to each other. Okay, so there's those 16 verses. Now, you know, I've already got the warning here. Let's go on 17 through 25. We've got two more sections to do. 17 through 25, I'm just calling miscellany. And so let's just read those. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron, to his sons, to all the sons of Israel. Say to them, any man of the house of Israel or of the aliens in Israel who presents his offering, whether it's any of their votive or any of their free will offerings, which they present to the Lord for burnt offering, for you to be accepted, must be a male. Here you go, Bill, you asked about this, or mentioned it. Must be a male without defect from the cattle, the sheep, or the goats. Whatever has a defect, you shall not offer. It will not be accepted for you. When a man offers a sacrifice of peace offerings to the Lord to fulfill a special vow, or for a free will offering of the herd or of the flock, it must be perfect to be accepted. There shall be no defect in it. Now, by the way, you might just write in the margin, see chapters 1 through 7. Chapters 1 through 7, one of the first things we dealt with, had to do with all these various sacrifices. Now we're hearing about a peace offering again. So there's some repetition now. 22. Those that are blind or fractured or maimed or having a running sore or eczema or scabs, you shall not offer to Yahweh, nor make of them an offering by fire on the altar to Yahweh. In respect to an ox or a lamb which has an overgrown or stunted member, you may present it for a free will offering, but for a vow, it shall not be accepted. Also, anything bruised or crushed or torn or cut, you shall not offer to the Lord or sacrifice in your land. Nor shall you accept any such from the hand of a foreigner for offering as the food of your God. For their corruption is in them. They have a defect. They shall not be accepted for you. Now, by the way, just a historical sidelight. In verse 25, nor shall you accept any such from the hand of what? Foreigner. Somebody who's not a Jew, a Gentile. You will find that throughout Jewish history, and it played quite a role in the eventual fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD, the Jews are regularly asked to sacrifice to their God Yahweh on behalf of the Roman emperor, on behalf of the governor, on behalf of, you know, whoever. And so these Gentile peoples had some respect for all gods, including the God of the Jews. And Titus was very upset when the Jews stopped their sacrifice, which Daniel had predicted in Daniel's prophecy. You know, but very upset because he wanted the favor of that God, even though he was in the process of defeating those people. So it comes from passages like this, 1 and 25, where they sought that. Okay, last little block is verses 26 through 33, which I've labeled even more miscellany. Okay, so they're just various and sundries. So 26, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, when an ox or a sheep or a goat is born, it shall remain 7 days with its mother. From the eighth day on, it shall be accepted as a sacrifice of an offering by fire to the Lord. Whether it's an ox or a sheep, you shall not kill both it and its young in one day. I don't know why. Nobody knows why. Speculation is rampant. But nobody knows why. God didn't explain it. We don't know. We have to leave it that way. The world may mock. They could just have all kinds of fun with this. You know, but they don't respect their God. Shouldn't be surprised. We accept it, whether we understand it or not, whether God gives a reason or not, it's still the fact of the matter. Now, 29, when you sacrifice a sacrifice of thanksgiving to Yahweh, you shall sacrifice it so that you may be accepted. It shall be eaten on the same day. You shall leave none of it until morning. I am Yahweh. So you shall keep my commandments and do them. I am Yahweh. You shall not profane my holy name, but I will be sanctified among the sons of Israel. When he struck Nadab and Abihu dead, and he told Aaron he couldn't even weep over him, what did he say? He said that. He said, I will be honored. I will. God does not yield to the hard-heartedness of mankind. God doesn't change his laws for the people that don't want to serve him. God doesn't care whether you want to serve him or not. He will be honored. His way, not your way, always. You shall not profane my holy name. I will be sanctified among the sons of Israel. I am Yahweh, who sanctifies you, who brought you out from the land of Egypt to be your God. I am what? Yahweh. Has he made his point? I guess. This is a different kind of God, because this is what? The only true and living God. Class dismissed.